Welcome to Minnesota Matters. I'm Tasha Radel, and I'm joined by MNN's Bill Werner, Brent Palm, and Mike Grimm. We're going to delve into what's happening in the North Star State. If it matters in Minnesota, we've got it covered. This week, cannabis is now legal in Minnesota. College football season is just around the corner, but first, repercussions have spread across the state and the nation after this week's fatal shooting of a black man, 33-year-old Rick Cobb II, by a state trooper during an early morning traffic stop on I-94 in North Minneapolis. MNN's Bill Werner is here to review what we know so far about what led up to the shooting, what's happened after, and the legal questions involved.
Tasha, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension says, according to the preliminary investigation, Trooper Brett Side saw a car drive past without rear lights on, and when he pulled the vehicle over, he learned the driver, later identified as Cobb, was wanted in Ramsey County on an arrest warrant for allegedly violating a protection order. Two other officers, Trooper Ryan Londrigan and Trooper Garrett Erickson, pulled up to assist. Those three troopers approached Cobb's car, asked him to get out, and he refused. Here is audio from body cam video of what happened next, and be advised, it is graphic.
How you doing, my man? I'm going to need you to step out, okay? We have some stuff to talk about, okay?
What?
We just have some stuff to talk about.
So I'm gonna just... Every time y'all talk about,
all right,
we have some stuff to talk about, y'all been taking me to jail, but for what?
Okay, we have some stuff to talk about. It's Ramsey County, we just have to have you step out.
Yeah, hold on. Well, Ramsey County?
Yeah.
Never.
Okay, do you want... No,
because I call my attorney right now. Hey, this ain't no funny
okay.
But if y'all talking about shit with Terry Young.
But you have to step out, okay?
Hold on, is it a warrant?
No, it's not a warrant. I need you to step out
though. Hold on.
I'll explain it all out when you get out of the car.
Hold on, is y'all finna get on some funny y'all keep it a buck with me, bro. But if y'all finna get on some funny with me, y'all can tell me right now.
Hand me the keys. Call my attorney.
Can
you hand me the keys?
Hand you my keys.
Hand me the keys to the vehicle.
Why?
Hand me the key to the vehicle.
Why?
Just hand me the key.
Can y'all keep it a y'all
yep,
pull me over my headlights.
Okay. Yep. And we already passed that. So like I said, you need to step out of the vehicle.
Okay, we passed that, so where we at then?
Okay. You need to step out of the vehicle.
So where are we at though now?
And I'm gonna explain it all when you step out.
But when you say step out of the vehicle, you go explain it to
this
me.
This is not a law
for y'all so
this hey man, you've been super cool.
Trooper Londrigan now opening the passenger side door, side opening the driver's door. Trooper Londrigan fires shots as Cobb's hand is reaching down for the shift lever. His other hand appears to be resting on the steering wheel. The BCA says troopers Londrigan and Side were knocked down as Cobb pulled away. Some media accounts say the car rolled away. The troopers couldn't catch up on foot. They returned to their squad cars and followed Cobb's vehicle a quarter mile down the freeway, then boxed it in as it was slowing to a stop against the inside median. Troopers attempted life-saving measures, but Cobb died at the scene. The BCA says law enforcement, while processing Cobb's car, quote, found two cartridge casings, a cell phone, and handgun, which was on the floor behind the center console in the back of Cobb's vehicle. At no point on available video is Cobb seen holding the gun, unquote. At a news conference later that day, State Patrol Chief Colonel Matt Langer said in cases where troopers use deadly force,
that triggers protocols within the organization, including a critical incident review. Our goal is for these things to never happen. And so when they do happen, we shift really quickly into why did it happen and is there absolutely anything we can do in the future to make sure it doesn't happen again.
But authorities have still not said why Trooper Londrigan fired his handgun at Cobb. Colonel Langer.
That is way too deep into the investigation and what the individual troopers were thinking, and I simply don't know what they were thinking. This is just a tremendously sad situation. It's sad from every perspective and for everyone involved.
Cobb's family demanded release of the body cam video, something law enforcement did shortly after. Cobb's mother, Nyra Fields Miller.
He has a twin, y'all. My God. You know? This is so hurtful. Worst days of my life. I'm hurting so incredibly bad for my heart, my soul, and my body. And the impact it has on his children, his siblings.
Activists with the Racial Justice Network demanded Hennepin County Attorney Mary Moriarty bring charges against the state trooper who shot Cobb. The group says Cobb asked if it was related to a warrant, and when the trooper said no, they say the average person would assume the officer had no constitutional right to demand that he step out of his vehicle. They say a second trooper then aggressively opened the passenger door, escalating the situation, and the officer instantly shot Cobb without warning, says the Racial Justice Network. Member Kim Millard says, quote, law enforcement regularly demonstrates no difficulty apprehending white suspects without suddenly feeling the need to kill them, unquote. County Attorney Moriarty said in a statement, I know that our community wants answers. We will work as swiftly as possible to provide them. She went on to say, we remain in communication with the BCA to make sure they gather the information we will need to make a decision. Once the case is submitted to us for review, we will use all the resources available to analyze the evidence and make a charging decision as quickly as possible. Unquote, Hennepin County Attorney Mary Moriarty. When we come back, we are going to talk with a top legal expert, Hamline University Professor David Schultz, on what Minnesota law says about when officers are allowed to use deadly force. That when Minnesota Matters returns.
Did you know that more lives are lost to lung cancer each year than breast, colorectal, and prostate cancers combined? Lung cancer will claim more than 135,000 lives this year. But new treatments have improved survival for many with the disease and offer new hope for many more. So does lung cancer screening with low-dose chest CT. The American Cancer Society and most major professional organizations recommend that adults ages 55 and older with a long history of smoking, even if they have quit, should talk with their doctor to learn more about lung cancer screening. Lung cancer screening saves lives by detecting lung cancer early when it's more successfully treated. So, ask your doctor if lung cancer screening is right for you. And if you smoke, ask your doctor to help you quit. Visit the National Lung Cancer Roundtable website at nlcrt.org. That's nlcrt.org.
Welcome back to Minnesota Matters on the Minnesota News Network. I'm Bill Werner. Was a Minnesota State Patrol trooper legally justified in fatally shooting a black man, 33-year-old Ricky Cobb II, during a traffic stop on I-94 in North Minneapolis early the morning of Monday, August 31st? What happened has a lot of Minnesotans wondering, and some, particularly in the metro area, on edge. We have listened to audio from an officer's body camera, and now let's bring in a legal expert. The question to Hamline University Professor David Schultz: under what circumstances does Minnesota law allow an officer to use deadly force?
Let's just talk about this one portion of the video, okay, where the officers are telling him to get out of the car, and he's refusing to do that.
But when you say, step out of the vehicle, you go,
yes,
explain
this
to me.
Is not allowed.
It is
also, this, hey, man, you've been super cool.
And then officers open the door of the car, and Cobb seems to be reaching down for the shift lever while having the other, with one hand, and while having the other hand resting on the steering wheel. And at that point, doesn't seem as if the vehicle is moving, but...
Get out of the car now!
One of the troopers fires his weapon, and the car takes off. The officers follow on foot, trying to catch up with the vehicle. They can't do that, so they run back to their squad cars. And one of the officers, as he is running back to the squad car, says, I just got blanking dragged, right? Expletive, mm-hmm. Dragged. So with this in mind, in terms of what the laws are regarding use of deadly force, might officers have been concerned for their own personal safety there, that car was going to take off? And in that case, might the use of deadly force be justified according to Minnesota law?
Okay, so let's think about what the standard is. What the standard is that an officer is entitled to use force, including up to and including deadly force, if an officer believes that he or she's life is in danger or the life of the public is in danger. And they have to make that decision based upon objective facts at the time and not based on what's called 20/20 hindsight. Okay. The reason why I lay all that out, is it possible that an officer in this situation here could have reached a conclusion that a person was posing a threat to an officer's life or perhaps the public, but in this case an officer, it is possible. But again, ultimately, it would be up to a jury to make that decision regarding it, because there are a lot of variables here. You know, when you know was there awareness or sense that officer was going to be dragged or going to be hurt? Was there a concern perhaps that the suspect was going to use the car to hurt somebody? I mean, there's a lot of things we'd have to sort of figure out here. But if an officer believed at that time, based upon a reasonable officer would believe that their life was threatened or the public was threatened, they would be justified in using deadly force.
But there are a lot of gray areas and a lot of unanswered questions about this. One thing that does seem to be clear in this particular case is the weapon, as it were, appears to be the potential weapon, appears to be the vehicle and not a firearm, it seems, right, at this point.
Absolutely correct. You know, much in the same way that we talk about criminal vehicular homicide, you know, where people who are drunk or impaired, you know, use a vehicle and kill somebody, and we essentially view the vehicle as a weapon. Again, one of the questions becomes here is that was an officer in danger of being potentially dragged, hurt, or something like that? And as a result of that, were the officers acting reasonably in using deadly force to prevent that from happening?
And I think another question that might arise here is they seem to be reaching into the vehicle perhaps, or were they actually inside? I would assume those are all of the areas that would have to be explored as to whether, in fact, the use of deadly force was justified.
And we'd have to have some kind of sense that we might not even see on the video at this point. What did the officers actually observe? You know, did they see a weapon? Were they reasonable in maybe inferring that he was grabbing for a weapon? Were they reasonable in terms of inferring that this individual might be trying to use the car to hurt themselves or others? Again, these become a lot of the factors that have to be considered. And I'm certainly not going to say today, one way or the other, you know, were the officers reasonable or not. Merely, I want to state what the law is, and perhaps, if there's an indictment, ultimately leaving it up to a jury to decide whether or not the officer acted within the boundaries of the law, or, like in the case of Derek Chauvin, did he exceed the immunity that he was granted as a police officer under Minnesota law.
That's Hamline University Professor David Schultz. Tasha, this case raises some very serious legal questions, and how that plays out, whether it be in the criminal courts and or in civil court, and the repercussions of the Minnesota legislature and by activists and the public at large, all that remains to be seen.
Thanks, Bill. More Minnesota Matters after this. Welcome back to Minnesota Matters. I'm Tasha Radel. It's now legal for Minnesotans ages 21 and older to use and grow marijuana. MNN's Brent Palm caught up with one of the key state lawmakers celebrating the end of cannabis prohibition.
Senator Lindsey Port from Burnsville, thanks for joining us today. And I know you were the author of the Senate version of the bill and worked with Representative Zach Stevenson of Coon Rapids to have that conference committee map the final legislation. What does it mean to you folks? How big of a deal is it? Cannabis is legal in Minnesota. Pinch me.
That's a little bit how it feels, Brent. It's a little bit wild that today it's sort of taking action. It's a huge deal. I know Representative Stevenson feels this way too, but we got to be the ones, you know, to really put the last pieces together and walk it over the finish line. But this is a process that has been in the works for decades. Communities have been organizing for this, advocates have been organizing for this, and it's been at the legislature now for a few years. So really, we just got to be the ones to really put the final stamps on it and walk it across the finish line.
It was kind of fun when former Governor Ventura showed up at the bill signing and had some great comments. That was interesting because people thought maybe in 1998 or 99 when he brought it up, it was kind of a far out idea.
Yeah, really, it has changed a lot over the last, 20 years. Certainly, the last 10, it's sort of swept the country in a pretty substantial way. I mean, we're really proud to do this in Minnesota, but we are the 24th state to do it. We're not breaking new ground in the way of legalizing. We're just hoping to do it in the way that learn the most lessons from the states that went before us and do it in a way that's uniquely Minnesotan and hopefully is a great model for other states to follow.
You know, obviously now people are going to be able to do what they want in their own home. I know some cities are talking about ordinances. We have a lot of that going on. But one of the things that might not get enough attention is this is going to affect some 60,000 people who might have a misdemeanor or a nonviolent marijuana offense on their record. This is a really big deal to those folks, right?
It's a huge deal. That is, in my eyes, the core part of the bill and why I took this bill on in the Senate. We knew expungement needed to be sort of the heart and soul of this bill. There could be no legalization movement without expungement. Prohibition has done really lasting damage to particularly communities of color. We know that white Minnesotans and Minnesotans of color use cannabis at roughly the same rate, yet you are 4 or 5 times more likely to be prosecuted for it if you are a person of color, particularly if you're a black man. So this is the first step in really starting to undo that harm from the state's perspective. And that is the piece that I am just absolutely overwhelmed and overjoyed that we got across the finish line. We're also the only state who's done this and made it automatic so that the onus isn't on the folks who have those misdemeanor convictions. The state will take that, the process on, and it will happen automatically. You don't have to apply for it. You don't have to search for it. The process is going to take a little bit of time, but it will happen automatically.
Hey, I have to ask, as you know, there was a small group of opponents of this bill who claimed that it doesn't prevent kids, I believe, from accessing cannabis. I'm guessing that you and anybody who supported this bill don't intend for kids to have access to marijuana.
Absolutely not. That's a ridiculous assertion, and anyone who's read the bill knows that that's not true. Possession of cannabis is legal in Minnesota today for adults 21 and older. It is not legal for kids. It will not be legal for kids. And actually, the strictest penalties that we put in the bill are for the sale to minors. So the best way to keep cannabis out of the hands of our young adults and our teens is by having a legal, regulated, age-verified market. I'm guessing folks who were selling drugs illegally on a corner weren't checking IDs, but by putting in the legal framework and a regulated, age-restricted market is the best way we have to reduce use among teens and young people. And actually, every single state that has legalized has seen the age of the first use of marijuana go up and the frequency of use among teens go down. So we are doing the responsible thing to make sure that our kids have the information they have, that cannabis is less available to them, and that the cannabis that exists out in the world in Minnesota is safe and regulated and free from, additional drugs that could be laced in it.
I know as of August 1st, the use and some cultivation of cannabis is allowed, but it's going to be more than a year until those products are available in retailers or dispensaries. Is that kind of the timeline you're hearing?
Yeah, what we're expecting is early 2025. We're hoping, and the governor's team is moving forward at a really quick pace. It seems like they are on track to hire the director of the Office of Cannabis Management by early September. And then really the in-depth process of setting up all of those systems and the agency that will oversee the regulation and the licensing will begin. So that is going to take some time. We're expecting January-ish of 2025 to be when the first licensed dispensaries will open. But the tribal nations in our state also have their own ability to grow and sell cannabis. And I believe Red Lake opened selling cannabis. So there are options for folks to buy legally. And we also have, the low dose market, which is very popular in Minnesota. And I expect that will grow tremendously over the next year. as well as you're able to grow your own at this point.
Well, Senator Port, thanks for joining us today, and maybe I'll reach out to you around the end of the year, and we can maybe talk about how the first few months of legal cannabis in Minnesota is going.
That sounds great. I'd be happy to talk about it. Thank you so much.
MNN's Brent Palm and Senator Lindsey Port of Burnsville. Time for our last break. More Minnesota Matters in 60 seconds.
It's Thursday night, and you're grabbing drinks with some friends. Started off with a pitcher for the table, which quickly becomes two. There's pool. And there's the photo booth.
All right, everybody, squeeze in. Say cheese!
Followed naturally by an order of wings. And another.
Can we get some extra ranch sauce?
Then there's the ceremonial nightcap.
So what are we doing this weekend?
And lastly, it's back to the car. Which, if you're buzzed... could be the most expensive night of your life. Getting pulled over for buzz driving could cost you around $10,000 in fines, legal fees, and increased insurance rates. Nothing kills a buzz like getting pulled over for buzz driving, because buzz driving is drunk driving. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Minnesota Matters. I'm Tasha Radel. College football season is just around the corner, and MNN Sports Director Mike Grimm gives us part two of his interview with the Big Ten Conference Director of Officials, Bill Carollo, who explains some of the new timing rules fans will see.
We are on a two-year cycle, although we put out a new rule book every year because we feel that's important. This is what they consider an off year. So most of it's administrative, and it had lots to do with the clock and the administration of the game. And if there was a new rule last year that didn't work as well as we thought and we wanted to tweak that, we could make those changes. But some of the real significant rule changes, X's and O's and blocking and targeting, unless it's player safety, we really do it about every other year.
Yeah. So in terms of this coming season, you mentioned maybe time of game and clock, implementing clock rules. What will we see maybe differently, or what will fans notice?
Yeah, there are a couple things that they might not notice, but it will be a little bit more efficient. We won't let teams extend the first or third quarter if there's a penalty on the defense, that type of thing. We're just going to roll to the next quarter versus play an untimed down. End of the first half, end of the second half, we certainly would extend that. So that's one. Back-to-back timeouts. You can have Team A taking a timeout and Team B, but you could take all three of your timeouts if you wanted to freeze the kicker, for instance. That seemed to take a lot of time away at the end of the game. Usually it's a kicker, it's a winning kick, and they're going to freeze them. So we've made that change. Team A, similar to the NFL, Team A can take a timeout, Team B could take a timeout. But after that, in the same dead ball period, no more timeouts. So I think that's a really good one. I mean, you get organized, get the right players on the field, take the timeout, but then that's it. We're going to play.
And is there rules now, too, with the clock? I saw there was speculation that the clock would not stop on first downs anymore. Clock would maybe, I mean, there was even some discussion on incompletions it might not stop.
Right.
What was the final determination there?
Yeah, we put a lot in there for discussion, but the one that did pass, first downs. So outside of 2 minutes, the clock would just roll. Similar to the NFL, and under 2 minutes, we will stop the clock on first downs, and that's a little bit of coaching adjustment. I think they're so used to getting a sub in if we get a first down, or especially on the defense if they make or don't make the first down, their substitutions are coming, different packages. Third and five is going to be different than first and ten. And both teams want to adjust. So they're going to have to manage that, and the officials have to manage it. It's muscle memory that every time they get a first down, we're looking, is it a first down, and we're killing the clock automatically. It's like breathing for the officials out there. So they're going to have to make sure they're listening, and it's not a reviewable play. So is it 2:01? Is it 2 minutes? You know, if it's 1:59, we should have stopped it, but replay's not going to come in and change that call. And if it's wrong, the officials on the field will get it right.
And the chain gang's got to be on the ball too, right? Because now they're all of a sudden charged with, hey, you can't take your time or dilly-dally with this. And I think at the Big Ten level, those guys are good. I wonder how it might impact you know, some of those lower levels to Division III and that, where those guys...
And they have less guys on it, and they have there's clips and there's markers and first down mark and a lot of stuff going on. There's like, you know, our chain crew is now 7-8 person. Committee where some of the lower levels are four people. Yeah. You know, you got someone's got to hold the stakes, someone's got to put the, you know, the down box down, and after that there's three or four other functions that they have to do too.
Yeah.
Record the plays and put the clip down but the officials are well equipped in hurry up offense. If they don't get there, we're dropping a beanbag. We know and we're gonna go.
Yeah.
And usually the down box guy will get there and put the stake in the ground.
Speaking of the Rose Bowls and the big games and working your way up, a guy from Minnesota who certainly did that was Mike Cannon. He's from Hutchinson, Minnesota. I know he worked his way up through the lower levels, was an official before he became a referee and led a crew, and before you know it, he's working a national championship game. He's retired, or he has retired. Last year was his last year. I know there's certainly people listening here in Minnesota that know Mike, and we've watched him. We always got a little special kick when the Gophers were playing. Obviously, he was totally above board, but hey, that's one of us out there that's doing a Minnesota game, and he's one of our own. So, what's he meant to the Big Ten over the years? And it's kind of neet to let a guy ride off into the sunset like that.
Yeah, he had just a terrific year, and you know, on the field I could go through, and it was not just a national championship, it was three national championships, it was Big Ten championships. He did so much on the field, and he checked every single box as far as starting at the bottom, having the right attitude, working his way up, took nothing for granted ever, never thought that, you know, I would do this or that, or they, you know, the sport I deserve this. He just worked his way up. He was one of our top guys. This is my 15th season, and he may be one of the top referees ever to come out of the Big Ten. And I was really fortunate to have him. And I had him when he was a deep official, and I moved him to head referee and did an awesome job. It was unbelievable. And now he's working for me. He's helping. He's giving back. He's one of our referee trainers. He does a lot of work. And I try to keep him close, you know, Missouri Valley games or more Midwest. But certainly he's capable of going anywhere. But I told him we'll start off. So he's still on the staff in the Big Ten now. He went to the dark side. He's got a suit on now, and he's going to games. But he's helping younger officials. And that's what I need, people like that are role models, that do it the right way, not for the money. And he's really successful in his banking business and family. I mean, he hit a home run in everything he's done. Good husband, good father, good grandfather. I mean, everything he does. So he's a perfect fit for the Big Ten.
Very good. Bill, always great to see you. It means football's around the corner. And thanks for the update and the insight.
Great. Thank you, Michael.
That's Big Ten Conference Director of Officials Bill Carollo with Eminence Sports Director Mike Grimm. That's going to do it for this week's edition of Minnesota Matters. Be sure to join us again next week on this MNN affiliate station, same time, same place. Thanks for tuning in. Until next time, I'm Tasha Radel.